The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. You're living in today's world that is a world filled with problems and questions, but very few solutions or answers. It's the age of the double standard, of the new morality, of the shifting of authority, the age of the sophisticated lie, the time of payola, rigged TV shows, and organized crime. Now, looking at the world in general, it looks like a big black bomb on a short fuse. The population explosion, the drought, famine, threat of starvation looms on the horizon, and war in Vietnam is on everybody's mind. The arms race is always with us. The race to the moon, the stockpiling of the atomic bomb, and what about the possibility of nuclear war by accident? So in the midst of all the pressing problems, people find it more and more difficult to live in any set or established way, and we're morally adrift without answers. People today are challenging almost everything. And one of the most discussed problems in the United States, at least, is the subject of morality, of marriage. And some people are even seriously discussing the idea of men marrying men and saying they ought to permit that, and others are attacking the idea of marriage. So everywhere people say old rules need changing, laws need revision, prayers disappear, sports are changing. Everything is coming under attack, from birth control to bombs, from race to religion, from marriage to morality. People seek new answers. But where do we look in the face of all these problems? Most people are pretty well defeated about the future. They don't believe there's any way out. They see gloom and doom and hellfire and brimstone whenever they look at the world news in general and whenever they listen to people talk about it in general, because you don't hear an awful lot of really good news. Now, I will confess that when I give you the truth of today's news, it sounds rather bad. And at first glance, that might sound a little bit contradictory with the name of this broadcast, The Good News of the World Tomorrow. But that's because, beyond it all, there is going to be some good news. That out of it all, there is nothing but good news ahead. Now, science and industry talk about a utopian dream of splendor, a Disney-like land of plenty and push-button ease. But, you know, I don't like to ignore the fact of the population explosion, the fact that maybe millions are going to starve in India this year and next, the fact that before too much longer the population of the United States will be absolutely double, the fact that every single month 1 million people are born in India, and that every year the total population of Australia is represented by their little bit of increase alone. I like to look at the entire panorama of the world and ask who, what, why, where, when, and how. How is it all going to come out, and go to the source to find out, is there any sense, any shape or meaning to the future, to this world, and the life itself? That's why I say I've got some good news. Because there is a source to which you can go to get a good long glimpse into the future, to see the outcome, to see the way out for people and our personal problems, our national, our moral, our racial, and our religious problems, and to see how the threat of famine and the population explosion causing the giant food wars of the future is going to be met, and to see what is the outcome, to make shape and meaning and sense out of life itself. Now, it's one of the most discussed subjects in the United States and around the world today. Simply, what is right and what is wrong? Teenagers want to know. But philosophers and educators can't tell them and admit they don't know. And religionists and theologians say they don't know. So who is to say? Well, that's exactly what the teenagers are asking. Somebody asks, what is your guide in life? Somebody says, well, I look at it this way, or my grandfather used to say, or I've got this philosophy. But now there is one source of truth to which you can go, which is not just your own inner mind or your own arguments. And you know what most of us call our philosophy of life is, after all, not a philosophy of or for life. It is in a little compartment of our brain that we label careful, high voltage, for discussion only, not for action. And what we do is, a lot of people sit around the cocktail table, and after belting down a couple of good stiff shots of booze over lunch or something, they finally drag out this one section that they're willing to discuss but not live by. So people say, who, me? I believe in live and let live. I believe that so long as you don't do anything which hurts anybody else, that this should be something that people let you alone. Why should they pick on you and make you conscious of a conscience? So the teenagers and philosophers all have their way of living, their philosophy of life.
But when you get right down to it, even though people have remarkably clear-cut philosophies of life sometimes, they will say they think they ought to do unto others. They'll recite the Golden Rule. They'll talk about being real good people. We like to appear this way to others. But when it comes right down to converting those philosophies into action and to living by them, well, that's something else again. Now, where do you go to get the source for the motivating factors in your life that regulate the really big principles in which you believe, that motivate and guide your decisions in business and the way you conduct your marriage, whether or not you believe in divorce, whether or not you believe marriage should be retained, whether or not you think prayers ought to be pronounced in school or kicked out of schools, whether or not you think a man is all right to cheat and lie and steal and jerk the rug out from under the boss and backbite and play politics around the organization? Where do you go for such source of truth, for such guide of life? There's only one source. And that source is something you can prove to yourself, and that is the word of Almighty God who does live. Now, I have a letter here from a 16-year-old girl who, of all things, says she's an atheist. And I thought, well, how on earth can somebody, age 16, become an atheist? Except, of course, if she simply had the desire to appear intellectual. But now, there is a person writing in the Bible who says anybody who has said in his heart there is no God is an absolute fool. That means that there must be an awful lot of people who are fools with degrees after their names, because you can get a list of atheists, and I mean it's a pretty impressive list the way human beings go. If there is such a thing as an impressive atheist, then there are a lot of people who are impressive in their various fields who claimed to be atheists. So it's rather remarkable that a 16-year-old girl could claim to have studied everything there is to know about evolution, researched every part of the Bible and tried to disprove it, gone through everything that is, the universe, the origin of it, the earth, the laws, everything that regulates our environment, and above all things, human intelligence itself, been able to systematically deny every bit of it, that it came from a source that had divine, all-knowing, creative power that is able to regulate and sustain that which has been produced and created, that had a plan, an overall design, a system, a great purpose in mind, and had been able to work all this out by age 16. That is a little bit remarkable. So most of us just pretty well accept what other people say, and we make it our own. But I keep wondering, why don't we keep Christ's name out of our religion sometimes? Because Jesus Christ and what he came preaching and predicting and talking about in the future, and then what a lot of people think about Jesus Christ, are two totally different things. The editor of Look magazine was talking about America in particular, but this so much applies to you people in Australia, because you like your beaches and your dog races and your track meets and all the rest of it. We like our sports and our fun, and we're becoming a fun-loving people, and we fiddle while the world burns. Are we a little bit hypocritical sometimes? When the going is good, we don't give God the credit, but when it gets rough, we blame him, and then finally, if it gets rough enough, we turn around and ask him to lift the burden and to make it easier. Well, the editor of Look magazine, a senior editor, Robert Muskin, said morality is the most intensely discussed subject in the United States today, and rarely will any two Americans agree on who is immoral or what is the moral thing to do. He said, we are witnessing the death of the old morality. In our world of masses of people, jet age travel, nuclear power, and fragmented families, conditions are changing so fast that the established moral guidelines have been yanked from our hands. No single authority rules our conduct. No church lays down the moral law for all. No tribal customs and taboos define the limits of our immoralities. We are free, he said, to be prejudiced or promiscuous, to cheat or chisel. We're left floundering in a money-motivated, sex-obsessed, big-city-dominated society. We must figure out for ourselves how to apply the traditional moral principles to the problems of our times, and many find this burden too heavy. Now aware, he wrote, of the pressures that our moral ideas worry and cause to come in on us and burden Americans, the editors of Look assigned him to talk with a broad selection of thinkers and leaders who are concerned about where we're headed, where we're going, what's ahead. The heart of the message that he gave is a warning. And here's what he said. We are heading into danger. We are in the midst of a moral crisis because the great majority who want to try to live moral lives no longer can be certain of what is right and what is wrong. Now, really, that statement
is a little ambiguous.
A lot of people are fairly certain of what is right and wrong, but knowing that human nature pretty much is expressed this way. Human nature wants to be right and be thought of as being right, but it doesn't want to do right. And so what we do is we try to figure what do we want to do, how do we want to live, what is going to please us, what's going to satisfy our personal vanities and lusts and desires, whether it's the pride of life, the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, lust of the senses, and so on. And then we try to figure out a way to bend the laws to make it all right. This is called licentiousness. It's a word that's used in the Bible time and again. Other people call it grace. It just depends on the way you hang the label. And remember, the label never changes the product. I don't care how pretty it's packaged and how much it says it's been preserved or what you're going to find inside. The product is still the same. So labeling it grace, which means that go ahead and sin and live today just like you did yesterday, and God will take care of it because he'll make allowances. He knows you're human and you fail, and so go ahead and sin. I mean, this is what people are being told today. They say they can't be certain of what is right and what is wrong. That's not quite correct. A lot of people are certain what is right and what is wrong, and they do have a conscience, and they have had some instruction. And they are aware of the fact there are laws, and they're pretty much aware of the fact you're not all that deaf, dumb, and blind about cause and effect. People just aren't that stupid. We can begin to see that the way we live in our families, and the way we have made mistakes in selection of a mate, and the way we've prepared for our homes, and the way we've conducted ourselves after marriage has resulted in our divorce rate of today. And we're not so dumb we can't see that unfaithfulness and infidelity, while a lot of people talk about it, and talk it up and make it for good TV and movie copy, and they write novels, and the great swill and the steady mill race of pornography and filth that is the great grinding grist mill of sex propaganda you read all the time today, notwithstanding, you can sit around and quip about it over cocktails and look at your magazine jokes about getting rid of one's wife all day long. But when you come right down to it, we all know that marital infidelity, unfaithfulness, fornication before marriage and adultery during and after marriage is one of the major and direct causes of wrecked and shattered homes and marriages. There is cause and effect. We're not that out of touch with reality. We can sit around and kid ourselves and philosophize that we're adrift and we can't really know what is right and what is wrong, but we know better. We really do know better. Well, we hate to admit we're in a crisis, but you can take a look at the evidence. Now, Jesus Christ said, by their fruits you know them. And the way you measure a product is by, you know, it's the old adage, you've heard, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, isn't it? So you look at the outcome, the results of something. What are the results of our money-dominated, sex-obsessed, big-city-motivated or dominated society? What are the results of life, the way people are living it today? Well, the result is pretty much divorce, crime, the beatnik, the racist, the wild kid, the price-rigging executive. A friend of mine said he was watching a show where they have some kind of a system where people can just press a button and hide behind anonymity, where they remain anonymous and nobody knows who did it. And he just asked, and I think they were Hollywood people, if I'm not mistaken, that were attending in the audience. Not just Hollywood citizens, I mean stars and so on. And he asked this group of people, how many of you, now nobody's going to be able to check up on you, of course, and it's knowledgeable ahead of time that anybody can lie out of it, how many of you cheat on your income tax? And do you know, 45% of them admitted they did? That's those who were willing to admit it. Isn't that something? We're living in the age of the sophisticated lie, where, well, anybody would have dinner with anybody who he knows is a cheat, a liar, a hypocrite. But now a burglar? A crime which is nowhere near so great in the sight of the great God who lays down the laws, so far as somebody that maybe he's way down and out and under great temptation, maybe he tries to steal something, you know, that kind of a fella, alongside somebody who lies and who is hypocritical, well, it just hardly no comparison. And yet, we admit we just love to have dinner and cocktails with somebody who we know is cheating on his income tax because we'd kind of like to learn how he did it, so we could find out how to do it. So around us we see the pregnant high school girl, the dope addict, the vandal, the bribed athlete, the rigged TV show, the uncared for aged, the poor, the criminal, television shoot-em-ups, violence, crime, brutality in sports, and the sex symbol of Americans, the much divorced, oft abused or used actress who becomes a great symbol for people and who ends up possibly a suicide and is supposed to mean that husbands have a warrant for at least four or five wives and several lovers in between. Now, is that the fruit of our modern society or not? Well, let's be honest. Yes, it is the fruit of our modern society. There's nothing moral about that, so people like to call it new morality. They say, well, actually, now, since we know human nature is basically immoral, and since human nature basically lusts and is filled with jealousy and vanity and greed, why don't we figure out a set of laws which will make lust and vanity and jealousy and greed right instead of wrong in the old accepted and classic sense? Well, the trouble with that is you can't change spiritual principles. We can sit around and legislate, and we can interpret our very basic documents of the foundation of our country, for that matter, but we can't change anything. You can't change living in spiritual laws. It's about time you look into the source of those laws for living and find out that the Bible does indeed present a system of ethics, that the Bible is a rule book by which you ought to live, that the Bible is a system of law, rules, regulations, moral standards, and that those rules and laws, when they are broken, exact a fearful and an immediate penalty, as well as a long-lasting penalty, unless or until they are repented of, unless or until they are completely repented of, which means two major things. One, to be deeply broken up and ashamed of yourself, to let your conscience break your heart and your mind and make you turn around and want to go the other way. And then secondly, the will and the perseverance to make the self do what you ought to do instead of what you want to do. Now, we can kid ourselves that other people can chit-chat about moral standards, and this will in some way gloss over our own conscience and assuage our own nagging worries and doubts, but they won't. And you're not going to get peace of mind, and neither are you going to have a successful marriage or happy children or a good, sound body and mind or a positive future or a future at all by philosophizing yourself down a blind alley of despair. You look at the world, there's not much hope. But if you look into that one source of truth and find out for yourself, what does it say about the future? How should you be living to make sure you can have a part in it? And what is that one system, that one way of life that is going to net you what you really want? Happiness? Success? Prosperity? Above all things, security? Oh, the swan song of religion, isn't it myriad? And doesn't it come in all shapes and sizes and packages? Seems like there's some that concentrate on prisoners inside the walls, and others that appeal to old people and shut-ins, and others that appeal to young people, and others that appeal to people living in other nations and of different languages and so on. And, you know, a lonely person, if a person is lonely and you say, are you lonely today? Well, and somebody says, yes, matter of fact, I am lonely. So you begin to listen. Well, why don't you find out why you're alive and find out where you're going and find out how to live by those laws that are going to net you what you really desire out of life. Now, I've shown that contrary to what this theologian said, and I quoted his words not long ago, it was published in an Alton, Illinois newspaper. It was by a university professor, and as a matter of fact, the funny thing was, it was by a professor of economics. But he was talking about the Bible, and I thought that was interesting. Now, if I were to tell this professor, now look, your textbook of economics isn't going to teach anybody how to handle money, he would say, what? Are you a nut or something? Are you crazy? Well, here's his quotation. He says, the Bible does not present a system of ethics. It simply isn't designed for that purpose. Jesus didn't come into the world to lay down a code of behavior. I would say, what? Was Peter insane when he said he set us an example that we ought to follow in his steps? Did the Apostle Paul not mean what he said when he knew imminent death was at hand and he was going to become a martyr for believing it? When he said, you ought to imitate and to follow me and to live the way I live, even as I live the way Jesus Christ lived? Didn't Christ mean what he said? When he commanded, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth forth out of the mouth of God. When the Bible says, to the law and the testimony, doesn't it present a system of ethics? Aren't the Ten Commandments ethical? Is there something unethical about the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, the historical, the prophetical, and all of the other parts of the Bible? People like to assign, as I said earlier, Proverbs
or philosophies of life to that portion or that part of their thinking which is labeled not for action, for thought and discussion only. Now, I could leave you with a nice thought, but that doesn't do you a bit of good unless you can use it. And this book of the Bible called Proverbs is not a group of casual suggestions. It's not a group of wise sayings or of just observations about life, but is a system of dynamic, active, living laws, which, if you live by them, will net you real results and rewards, which, if you break, are going to come crashing in on you and wreck your business, your children, your home, your marriage, your mind, your life, your future, and everything else. Now, God says wisdom is available. He says all you've got to do is to become observant for a change and take a look around you. He said in verse 7 of the first chapter of the book of Proverbs, "The fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." The fear of the eternal is a pretty rare commodity today, because so many people aren't sure he does exist. And those who claim they know there is a God or say there is a God don't talk about the God who is the creator, the personality of the Bible, the Father of Jesus Christ, the one who wrote these prophecies, who inspired them to be written and stands back of them. We like to create a God in our own image. We like to have a comfortable God who doesn't come along saying, "Why didn't you keep my laws? Why don't you live the way I command you to live?" We like to have a God that is a still, quiet little voice that whispers in soothing tones and says, "Well, you're not so bad. Sure, you're a cheat. You're a liar. You're a hypocrite. Yeah, that's right. You play politics. You try to jerk the rug out from under those above you. You belittle others and magnify the self. Yes, you're selfish, sure. Mm-hmm. You have your own attitudes and point of view that you're pretty proud of, and you're real short-tempered with other people. But you're all right. You'll make it somehow." Now, that doesn't make sense. You can't have a conscience that says, "Now, look, you're a real wart of a character. You're a quad. I mean, you know that you're a scoundrel and a scallywag, and you know you cheat in your income tax, and you're willing to shoplift and lie to get your way out of to get yourself out of a situation. You watch apprehensively in the rearview mirror whether there's a traffic cop lurking behind you because you know you're breaking the law. But you're not such a bad guy. After all, this is the kind of a voice of conscience people want." So it's pretty much the kind of a voice of conscience that professional conscience assuagers are offering. They're saying, "Well, you're not such a bad guy. You'll make it okay. After all, aren't we all in the same boat? We're all just a pack of struggling humans. We'll make it okay." Well, we're not making it, fellow humans. We're just not making it, are we? Because we're about to crowd ourselves off the earth, or else we're going to blast ourselves off the earth, whichever one comes first. And you can't deny these problems because they're with us every single day. Now, the question is, have you proved there is a God, and does the Bible really carry weight and authority over your life? Does your God tell you how to live? Does your God give you any orders? Does your God intervene in your personal life? Does your God have a whole set of rules by which you live, and you tremble in fear to disobey those laws? You either live by them, or you know you're going to get hurt if you don't. Is your God like a loving father who so loves his children he wants them to see how to live correctly and how to reap all the benefits and rewards, so he wants them to obey and live by the rules of that home and to live in a law-abiding society, the family unit? Is your God the God of the Bible, the creator of heaven and earth, the sustainer of every law, the father of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, or is your God one you made up in your own mind? Now, if he is, well, then keep the name of the real God out of your religion and admit it to yourself. If Jesus Christ, I mean the one you talk about, is not the one of the Bible, then look into it and admit it to yourself, because I'll tell you about the letter I got from a fellow who had done what I would advise all of you to do. He said, "You know, I'd heard all these things, I couldn't believe it, so I decided I would just take a test, and I divorced from my mind and washed out of my memory all of my preconceived ideas and everything I had been taught about the Bible by other people. And I began at Matthew, the first chapter, and I decided I'll just read this objectively, just like plain English or whatever language, and see what it says." And he said, "I did, and I was absolutely shocked that it says things I never knew before. It's completely different than I thought it was. And what it says in the Bible is totally different from what people have told me about the Bible." Now, you'll have that exact same experience if you're not afraid to begin it. And after all, that's not some book I've got from any publisher someplace or for you. I've got nothing to sell. I'm not selling Bibles.
I'll give you a lot of booklets that you can check out in your own Bible and find out whether or not they can be proved. But if you want to take a test like that, why don't you start at Matthew 1 and just read at least 6 or 8 chapters? I'll guarantee you by the time you get through 7 or 8 or 9 chapters or less, you'll begin to get shock after shock when you find what the Bible says is totally different from what you thought it said. And of all things, you will certainly be a little surprised, as I was, at this economics professor saying the Bible does not present a system of ethics, especially if you'll read Matthew 5, 6, and 7. So why don't you start on that project yourself? And in the meantime, write in for these booklets on Does God Exist? And the proof of the Bible. Because they will absolutely prove it to you. And they pull no punches. They'll really show you where to find the proof for yourself. Now also, in that same line, you need to write for these booklets I've mentioned in past programs about prophecy. We're living right now in a time of increased earthquake activity. And here's this full-color booklet, The Truth About Earthquakes, that show you the statistical evidence from science, the factual pictures taken on the spot of these fantastic earthquakes that occurred up here in Alaska, in North Africa, over in Iran, Yellowstone, various parts of the world down in southern Chile, and also what science says is going to come, and then the whole thing in the light of Bible prophecy, because Jesus Christ of Nazareth prophesied you would be living in a time of wars, rumors of wars, drought, famine, and earthquakes in different places, and this booklet shows you more about it. It's free of charge. There's no price for it. And you'll also want to write for this booklet on the wonderful world tomorrow, what it will be like. Here are the two widely divergent views of politicians and government leaders and then scientists of what they secretly feel the world tomorrow is going to be like. Many of them feel it won't even be here. And then scientists talk about a wonderful, glittering, sort of a gigantic Disneyland of leisure, of more pleasure and ease and luxury for the few, but more starvation, more riots, more wars, more upsets. For the many. But all the way through this booklet, you will see solutions. You will see the predictions about the outcome. You will see present-day trends and conditions in the big countries around this world analyzed and solved. You will see tomorrow's headlines today. You'll see the really big news that is not being reported anywhere else about the way this world is going to be. And included, one of the most fantastic newspapers you've ever read. Sort of a could-be newspaper, the way the world news could be today, and believe it or not, the way it will be in not very many more years. The best news you could read, an article about total disarmament. Articles about the solution to the big problems that everyone worries about today. Solving our economic problems, bringing people out of poverty, solving the racial hatreds and strife of people. Making wasteland productive. Solutions to the problems of weather. Solving the problems of divorce, solving the problems of education and school dropouts, what have you. It's all here in this newspaper that is contained inside the booklet. Now, you don't have to ask for it separately. The booklet is entitled, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. This booklet, as no other does, shows you exactly the meaning and the purpose of this broadcast, The World Tomorrow. That's why it's by the same title. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It's free of charge, no price, no one's going to call on you. We don't give your name to someone else. We protect it and safeguard it in our own IBM files, and we'll send it to you immediately upon receiving your request if you'll write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station and write for the booklet immediately. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.